it's part of the parentage of some of them.
Thank you, Margaret. I'm Emily Carter. I'm a soil scientist with the Forest Engineering Unit in Auburn, Alabama. And what I'm presenting today is some of the data we collected on a study looking at thinning in Kentucky. Primarily, our goal or our role was to look at the productivity and impacts related to the thinning. But this was done in a context of a much larger scale project looking at several facets of restoring our silvicultural prescriptions to the area and also looking at forest health prescriptions for disease management or invasive species management. And I'm showing on the lower left here partners that participated in it. There were components related to wildlife, bat recovery, chestnut restoration on the site. So there were several participants. University of Kentucky, Eastern Kentucky, Tennessee, and then the Northern and Southern Research Station. My co-author is Jason Thompson. He's an engineer, a support engineer in our unit, and he was responsible for collecting the soil disturbance and then assisted in the soil sample collection. So the project was located in the Daniel Boone National Forest, the London Ranger District, and it's in this area of eastern Kentucky. And it's a hardwood, it's a mixed hardwood stand, and this is where they located the project. The drivers for this were primarily to restore oak to the area. It was had very low vigor. A lot of the advanced reproduction wasn't there, so this is an attempt to get them to restore oak to the site. At the same time, they were also attempting to stave off gypsy moth infestations that were, they were seeing areas here in West Virginia and northern Kentucky where gypsy moths were showing up. So that the idea was to thin the area in hopes that this would limit the movement of gypsy moth into the area. So there were four thinning treatments that they applied to the site. The first one of these was a shelterwood with reserves. This was the treatment where the highest number or highest amount of basal area was removed from the site. There was an oak shelterwood. This was a chemical treatment on the site where they were reducing the density using chemical treatments. There was a typical thinning where they reduced the basal area to comply with stocking charts for oak. And then an oak woodland where they reduced the basal area, and then the idea would be to reintroduce fire into the site. These were replicated three times, and they were divided into mesic and xeric sites so that there would be a difference in terms of soil moisture habitat in the area. Now, when I got involved, when I was asked to get involved, there was one treatment left, one area that had not been harvested. So all the data I have is focused on this shelterwood treatment down in this area here. And we did take samples in this chemically treated area, so it received no disturbance, no harvesting disturbance. So all my data is related to one stand, the shelterwood with reserves. The area is located in the eastern coal region of Kentucky. It's a Pennsylvanian age, and so the parent material is sandstone, silt, shale. The site that we eventually didn't do soil sampling in the whole stand. We just did a hill slope area on it, and in that area there was it was very steeply sloping. The soils can be gently sloping, but this was in a fairly steep area. It was very deep clay subsoil layers, and the predominant soil series that we determined was located there was a shellacta silt loam. And if you look at the NRCS interpretations, it's very suitable for wood, for woodlands, has very slight limitations for machines or harvesting machines, and then is very slightly, is very little erosion hazard on the site. So in any of the studies we do, we oftentimes will do soil disturbance classes. And the classes you pick are going to depend on what you think you're going to find as far as disturbance. These are typical of the types of disturbance classes we use in many of our studies predominantly in the southeast United States. They would change if we went to another region. The ones that are in red are the ones that we identified in the plot where we took soil samples. So those will show up on some of the other data. But the ones we typically use are untrafficked, where no trafficking was obvious. Traffic with litter, that litter was still there, but you could tell that a tire had gone over it. There were three where soil might have been exposed due to the machine movements over the site. You could have the topsoil, some of the litter removed and topsoil exposed, or sometimes spinning of the wheels brought up some of the mineral soil. And then there were times where maybe it got mixed. We didn't see those too often, but they can exist. The ones that we found on our site that we examined with soil sampling were ruts. So you actually saw a depression in the landscape. And there was typically about a little less than 4 inches, but we just classified as 6 inches. And then there's times where you, on your transects, where you'll hit rocks or some other object that you don't want to, it's not part of the harvest, so it's classified as non-soil, and then we always identify how much slash is on the site. And this last one, soil deposit on surface, we very rarely see that, but we often keep it in our system. Then we couple that with soil core, with bulk density sampling, and with penetrometer sampling. So we did this on our hill slope area when we reclassified the site for soil disturbance after the harvest, and then took soil samples out of there. So when we look at all the treatments, we can see that in the Sheltonwood with reserves in green, it had the lowest amount of undisturbed area and had the highest amount of highly disturbed area, I'll call it, and then had a high degree of slash due to the amount of basal area that they removed, and then pretty much similar amounts of traffic with litter, where there was some movement of machines, but it didn't look very, it was slightly disturbed, we usually refer to it. So the site, the stand that we used, which was unit 32, this is the total soil disturbance classes for the site. And you can see that the traffic was litter, had the highest percent, and then it was followed by soil exposed. So there was quite a bit of disturbance on the site. When we looked at the plot level that we did, you see that most of the disturbance was traffic with litter, although there was some rutting on the site. So what we did was, sampled by disturbance class, I put all the data together first to see what it looked like before and after. We did get out there before they harvested that area and collected samples and then followed it up with a post-harvest sampling. And as you would expect, you could see that there's an increase in bulk density with depth. We went down to about 60 centimeters and found that there was an increase with depth, and it was primarily affecting the top 40 to 50 centimeters. If you look at the gravimetric water content, at the time that the harvest occurred, it was fairly low, about 10%, and that was mostly consistent through the profile. And afterwards, when we went back and sampled afterwards, and this was usually a couple months after the harvest, and occurred probably in the winter, late winter, early spring time frame. So the plots had accumulated some moisture in the soil surface and might have been limited by the disturbance. One thing we did was we collected bulk sample, and what we wanted to do was compare that with a Proctor test. That is, what is the maximum compaction that you would likely get with these soil types? So we did the Proctor test, and on the soil surface, found that the maximum compaction that we might expect would be about 1.53, 1.54, and that would occur at what the engineers refer to as the optimal moisture content at about 20% of gravimetric water. In the subsoil, that turned out to be about 1.78, and the optimal moisture content would have been about 15%. So we went and applied that to the data we got, and you can see that we weren't near, even in the post-harvest anywhere near what would have been the maximum compaction in the soil surface. So a bulk density from the harvest action probably wasn't, we didn't get any indication that there's going to be a problem with that site. With the water content, you can see that we really didn't reach in the upper 15, the 20%. We really were below that at the time of harvest. So we were possibly protecting the site by harvesting at that moisture range. We did parse the data and look at by disturbance class. So we have undisturbed traffic with litter, and then this is the rutting disturbance class. You can see that none of it exceeded what we found as a maximum compaction for the at least for the soil surface, and definitely did not exceed the maximum compaction we found for the subsoil. We looked at water content, and you can see there's quite a lot of variability. It could be the time of year that we took the samples. Maybe you would expect that there might be higher water levels than the undisturbed, mainly because probably any rainwater that had hit the site would probably percolate into the profile. But the changes that occurred in the traffic with litter and with the rutting, probably the water percolation or infiltration in the site might have been limited by the amount of disturbance, by the bulk density changes. I did mention that we took soil strength, and as we all know, that soil strength is affected by bulk density and moisture. So I took the soil strength readings that we had from that site and looked at it in context of bulk density and did it for pre-harvest and post-harvest. You can see that the pre-harvest bulk densities, the range in values from 0.75 up to about 1.18, the corresponding soil strength, you can see that it increased rapidly up to 2.5. And that probably was attributed to the fact that the moisture levels were very low at that time. You can see that in the post-harvest that there's more change in bulk density, but it didn't have as much effect on the soil strength in the site. So that's probably due, we're probably looking at the influence of soil moisture at the time and post-harvest, and it would probably indicate that there's not much, there wouldn't be a problem at that point in time with regeneration in the site. We also looked at it in terms of gravimetric water. You can see that water influenced the soil strength determinations at about 15%, where we saw that soil strength was lowest. But as water declined, and this was about the level of gravimetric water where the harvesting occurred, that the soil strength values were very high, and they were less more influenced by water in the post-harvest. 3 minutes, okay. So the conclusions on that are not very, you know, they're not very astounding, that it occurred at less than the optimal moisture content where maximum compaction would occur, that bulk density did not reach a maximum, and that bulk density and soil strength from this data set did not appear to be, would not appear to be a limiting factor in the regeneration. Unfortunately, we didn't apply it over a lot of the treatments, but this might give them an indication of what to expect in terms of regeneration. The in the Central Hardwood Conference in 2010, Callie Schweitzer, the second citation there, gave a talk on the silviculture aspects of this project. And then Jason Thompson provided one on the soil disturbance classes for the entire site. So if you're interested in that, looking up those citations, and then I'm hoping to follow it up with the soil. And any questions? Larry. You know, I'm sure we've heard this incessantly. Budget. This was an afterthought for them to pull me in there. I had talked with Bob, my boss, several times about going back to a lot of the sites, and I would assume that it would probably, as long, and I'm interested in more how the water, how the moisture content changes on there. And we talked to the silviculturalists about following it up in the National Forest, but there's no movement to do that right now. And I would expect that we would get, you know, a lot of variability in the measurements, and that would have an impact on them.
And at least if we had the other measurement, like when it was all wet January or February, you'd have a better comparison for, you know,
Well, those, I'm sorry, those were taken in January, in February, March, the post-harvest. So the profile was pretty wetted up by that time.
But do we have anything for associated like pre-harvest that was undisturbed still at this point?
I have the chemical site. I have data from that I didn't show in this study.
I'm just guessing that those differences will reverse, that you're not going to get that lower resistance to penetration.
Oh, right, at that, right. And hopefully I'll be able to prepare, have all that data in a paper that I'm trying to write up right now on it.
Is there a way to go ahead and take out that, again, that moisture effect, like utilize the moisture at one point as sort of a co-barrier or something, and then you can look more directly at the clay and some of the other things without its influence on moisture? Is there anything to approach that?
Leticia, could you come up and answer that question?
Thank you, great question.
Yeah, state the question and then
answer it. Not there. Yeah.
Thank you. So yes, that it's of course a very interesting part, because the soil moisture interacts with the electrical conductivity as well as the soil properties. And why I use the principal component analysis, it was for that, to add all the soil properties and to be able to extract the most important in order to mix everything. So this response and after the simple correlation show clearly the strong evidence that the electrical conductivity is linked with clay content and or sand content. After different there is also other possibility to study that by a more direct implication. Yeah.
Any further questions for Leticia regards to this topic? Okay. Thank you. 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 And Lorraine Kelly, Shrevy Reed Mustard Habitat, any remaining questions for you?
Lorraine, how well does the mustard reestablish on mine disturbed sites? Have you got mine spoils? Does it come back in?
We don't know. Lorraine, can you answer up? Because, sorry. But, so how, if you could repeat the question, and then answer. Thank you.
You were asking how well the sugar reed reestablishes on disturbed mine areas?
Yes.
And so far, the sugar reed mustard is only growing in naturally in undisturbed areas, so we don't know the answer to that question. It has been, we did try to grow it in the greenhouse, or Matt Lewis tried to grow it in the greenhouse, which is the only situation where people have tried to propagate it outside of its natural area, and they were not able to successfully grow the sugar reed in the greenhouse. Yes.
You might have covered this, I don't remember, but what's the specialness of the mustard? Is it a food source or?
There hasn't been a lot of studies done yet on benefits of the sugar reed mustard. Of course, it's an endangered species, so we always want to protect those because we never know what kind of, you know, import they have on our ecosystem or
so
what kind of.
Range has become limited over time because of.
You know, we don't know the answer to that. If it was, if it used to be more expensive, and then, you know, it's had a hard time maintaining its establishment in the environment, or whether it's expanding right now, it's possible that.
Very, very, very rare.
Is it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There are three endangered reed mustard species in the Colorado Plateau that are on the federally endangered list, and it's been a huge concern for Fish and Wildlife Service because there are so few plants. Actually, in this research, we have found more plants than they originally thought on federal banned land, on BLM land. But the concern is that it was extremely rare to begin with, and now it's right in the way of where they want to develop oil shale. And so there's some hydrocarbons in the unit right below the plant, but the main thing is the oil shales are below where the plant occurs.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're going to have to tear up everything, strip line everything to get to the oil shale down below, which would strip out whatever potential habitat there is for restoration or conservation efforts. That's a big concern. It's just very, very rare, and we might be ripping up any potential habitat with the expanded oil shale production.
And as far as other benefits the plant might offer, there's some other mustards that they have found contain some alkaloids that are anti-cancer. And no studies have been done yet on this particular plant as far as medical benefits or some other benefit directly to humans. Any other questions?
Yeah.